Don't make me laugh. Hi, everybody. I'm Janice. I am an alcoholic. Walking in these doors is like coming home for me. It's really nice. God, it's emotional. I wasn't expecting this. This was my home for a lot of years. And God, I didn't think I'd cry till a lot later. This meeting changed my life and a lot of people in it. And I will forever be grateful to this meeting. So when Chris asked me to speak, my first response was crap. You know, it was just really horrifying and terrifying to me. Because I just have a lot of respect for this room and a lot of respect for the people in it. And I was very humbled by the request. And, you know, my first instinct was, no, I can't possibly do that. But, you know, my first instinct is usually wrong. So I said, yes, thank you. So, and that was only like 4 days ago, so it didn't give me a whole lot of time to think about it or worry about it, which is good, because that's how God works in my life today. My home group is A Vision for You on Thursday nights in Union, New Jersey. We have a step discussion meeting, and it's a really solid group, and I'm a really grateful member of that group. But this was my first home group, and I had been around AA for about 20 years before I walked into, about 15 years before I walked into these doors, and was never able to really get sober. I was abstinent for a bunch of years, but never learned about a program of recovery till I walked in these doors, and a teacher was put in my life and started going through the work. I started, you know, from my earliest memories, I was always uncomfortable in my own skin, always. I was always seeking something outside myself to make myself feel better and feel whole, and I was just always in fear. And when I started using alcohol for the first time in high school, I realized that alcohol was a power greater than myself. And my first spiritual awakening was a result of alcohol. And alcohol did for me all those things that I could not do for myself from the first time I drank it. You know, it made me feel prettier and stronger and wiser and popular, and it fixed me, you know, and it worked. For many years, it worked. I came to believe in the power of alcohol the same way I've come to believe in the power of God in my life today. But, you know, I saw it working for other people. They told me to try it, that it would work for me. And I did, and I came to rely on it every day, pretty early on. I was always seeking some kind of spiritual experience. I went off to college and started following the Grateful Dead around the country. And thought that was a spiritual experience. And it was, because I started taking a whole bunch of other chemicals that brought me to a whole bunch of other places. And that's how I lived my life for a couple of years. My family never knew where I was. I would disappear for weeks on end. And was doing a whole lot of chemicals. I was pretty much drinking every day, but discovered a whole lot of other things as well. And it just, I was ingesting something every day, from the moment I woke up until the moment I passed out at night. And still actually doing pretty well in school, still showing up and doing pretty well. And in the summer, no, winter break, when I was 19, I'd been in school for about a year, I fell into the world of modeling through no pursuit of my own. It was one of those weird stories. I was on a beach and this photographer and yada, yada, yada. Next thing I know, I'm in New York City and on a plane to Barbados for a magazine. And I was just thrown into this life that I had never anticipated or expected. And modeling is not really a breeding ground for spirituality. Especially somebody that comes into this business having absolutely no sense of who I was and being so incredibly uncomfortable and living in fear every day. And the only way I knew how to squash that fear was to ingest more chemicals. So I'm in this business where people are paying me a whole lot of money for the way I looked, and I was really, really uncomfortable with that. Because I always had this constant fear every single day that I went to work that one day they were going to figure it out. I had this constant fear of being found out. You know, one day they were going to figure out, you know, she's really not that pretty, and I would never work again. I always felt less than. I always felt unworthy of what I was doing. I never, ever felt comfortable, and I was actually really successful, but was never comfortable, ever. And, you know, started living this lifestyle that I kind of thought was glamorous at the time. You know, I was hanging out with a lot of famous people and doing a lot of famous drugs and hanging out at all these clubs and traveling around the world. And, you know, I'd go to all these clubs and basically hang out in the men's bathroom all night, you know, doing various substances. And I'd be up for days on end and showed up for work most of the time. As long as I could get what I needed, I could show up for work. And I had really developed a liking for a lot of other substances. And if I couldn't get those, I would always have liquor on me because I had to have something because I became horribly physically dependent on a variety of things in my life. And if I didn't have them, I could not go to work. And where I had to go to get the stuff that I needed, you know, I had to go to some really bad neighborhoods. And I couldn't, like I said, I could not show up for work until I had what I needed. So thusly, I was late a lot. I'd have to do a fashion show. I'd be 20 minutes late, which didn't really work out because I'd missed my pass on the runway and I got fired. And I would show up for work so inebriated and in the bathroom half the time, and I couldn't keep my head up in the makeup chair. And they'd call my agency, and they'd come collect me. And thus started my round of rehabs and detoxes. I went to my first rehab, I think, in 1987. I got shipped out to Minnesota, didn't really want to go, but I went to placate my agency. And I walked out of rehab after 28 days. There was like a little mini mart across the street, and I walked across the street with my little plastic bracelet on and ordered wine coolers, you know, and they just laughed at me because I'm sure I'm not the first person that they saw my little bracelet, and I'm sure I'm not the first person that's ever done that. So drank on the plane the whole way home and continued doing what I was doing. I don't, you know, I lasted a little while and ended up back at rehab in a different place in Minnesota. I don't know why I always went to Minnesota, and I always went in the middle of winter, always. I was always in Minnesota in December. But I remember that I was convinced, because I didn't know any better at that time, that this was purely a physical disease. As long as I could detox, as long as I could stop the physical need for all these things I was putting in my body, that I'd be okay. So being a model, I had to travel a lot. And I would go on these trips if they were for a week or 2 weeks or whatever, and I'd bring a whole bunch of stuff with me to help me detox. And it would work, you know. After a week or two, I no longer had a physical need to put something in my body. Physically, I was detoxed and I was okay. And knowing nothing that I know now about the mental obsession and all that stuff, I had no clue. I remember I used to see people on the streets, and it just seems so stupid now, but I used to want to do the Keith Richards treatment, you know, like go into a hospital and get this blood transfusion. And I would see people on the street that I thought looked healthy, and I was like, if I could just have their blood, I'd be okay. And that's how I thought back then, that if I could just detox myself, I'd be okay. So I did, and I would successfully land at JFK with my luggage, no longer with the physical need. And I would basically take a taxi from JFK to the nearest bar or, you know, to see Flacco in the corner to get other things. Not even going home, going straight to what I wanted. I did not know how to live a day sober in my life. I could not even fathom it. I went to Minnesota again, and they wanted me to go to a halfway house in Duluth. And I went up to Duluth, and I didn't stay in Duluth. I didn't go to Duluth. I went back to New York because my whole attitude was, don't you know who I am? And I got to go back to this job. My job's really important. And I went back to New York, and I was loaded within, I think I lasted 2 days. I think I stayed in New York for a couple months, and I knew it wasn't working out, and I went back to Minnesota again, and begging to go to a halfway house. And I did. I went to this halfway house in St. Paul for a few months. And you know, I did what they asked me to do, and I stayed clean for a few months, and rehabs and detoxes never really worked for me. I was loaded like the last week I was there. I started, drinking and doing various things again and didn't think anybody knew. And my mom actually flew out for my graduation. And I got up and, in front of the whole halfway house, like 100 people or so, and loaded, accepted my coin and was loaded. And my mom was in the audience. My mom was so happy because she thought I was finally sober. And I got taken into the office and confronted, and I had to admit it, and, crushed my mother, just crushed her. And she flew back to New Jersey and basically was done with me. She basically said to me, don't call me again until you're sober. And I was not reliant on my mom for financially. I hadn't been reliant on my parents since I was 18. I was very self-supporting. I had a great job, and I had lived alone since I was 18 in the city. So I wasn't financially dependent on them for anything. I saw them as little as possible, because going to see them, meant that I had to bring a whole bunch of stuff into their house that I wasn't comfortable doing. I'd go visit them. I'd be up all night in my old bedroom. It was so bizarre. She'd come in the morning, and I'd pretend I was sleeping. I'd been up all night. So anyway, after that, she's like, just don't ever call me again. Because, like I said, I wasn't dependent on them, but when there was drama going on, I called them. Just because I had nobody else in my life. I mean, I got arrested once in New York City. Being where I shouldn't be, in a part of town I shouldn't be in, doing stuff I shouldn't be doing, I got arrested and thrown in jail. And I remember I was in the back of the cop car. And I said to the policeman, don't you know who I am? How grandiose was I? I was just another drug addict on the street to them. And threw me in jail, and I was in jail for a few days. And my boyfriend at the time called my mother and, said, your daughter's in jail. And he actually called my agency, too. I was with Eileen Ford. He called Eileen Ford and said, Janice is in jail, and she's a drug addict, and she's an alcoholic. And he called my mother and said, Janice is in jail, she's a drug addict, she's an alcoholic. And my mother's like, well, where is she in jail? And he didn't know. So my mother drove into New York City and tried to find me. And she does not do New York City. And it was the middle of the night, and she drove into New York City looking for me, which I didn't know. But I was in there for a few days, and they brought me up in the middle of night court or something, chained to, other women, and as they bring me up, I look out in the gallery, and there's my mother. And I was so horribly ashamed. Because when I was up there, when they read the charges against me, they said a couple words that my mother had no idea, the substances that I was using at the time. And I just stood there mortified. And, after they released me, I went and I sat down next to her, horrified. And she just leans over to me and she said, I love you. And as painful as it was, she knew exactly what she needed to say at that moment. And, you know, I went off again and lost touch again. But anyway, my mother's been through a lot with me, God bless her. So, like I said, they basically disowned me after my stint at the halfway house. And after I left that halfway house, things went downhill really, really fast. I reached a bottom that I can't even fathom of today. It's amazing I'm alive. I moved to Chicago for a little while looking for work. Let me back up by saying when I was modeling, when I was working a lot, I would pull these geographics. I would do anything I could to get out of the situation I was in, and one of mine was geographic cures, and I would travel around the world, and I would leave the United States every September and live somewhere else in the world until around Christmas time. And I would try to pick countries where I didn't think I could get some of the stuff that I really wanted to get. And what I would do is the moment I landed in a foreign country, Paris, Milan, Tokyo, Sydney, wherever it was that I would go to work, I would go to meetings. And I would sit and I would go to another fellowship and I would sit there long enough to find out what part of town I shouldn't be going to. And then I would get up. It's pretty good. And then I would get up and, thank you very much and go and get what I needed and exist for the next 3 months. But there was one country in Tokyo. There, the penalty, if you're caught with drugs, it's like, life sentence. So there's really nothing there. And basically I would... I drank round the clock. I remember I lived in an apartment with other models, which was like a surreal existence because the only people that could speak English were other models, so those were the only people I talked to. It was very bizarre. And at 7 in the morning, I would... In Japan, on the streets, they have these sake machines. They don't have soda machines, they have sake machines. So at 7 in the morning, I'd be downstairs on the sidewalk, my hand shaking. I'd be pumping yen into the sake machine. It spits out a can of sake, and I'd hold my nose and throw that stuff back. 7 in the morning, and that's how I got through my day. That's how I got through 3 months in Japan. Loaded. So I went to Chicago after the halfway house. And just really, really, really sick. Really sick. I was living with some people that were... I actually wasn't living. I started living with somebody and I got kicked out. And I was like squatting in somebody's apartment. And I was almost homeless. I was basically homeless. And I went to a part of town again where I shouldn't go. I heard like the worst part you can go into Chicago, and I went there. And I got a gun pulled to my chest. 4 or 5 guys surrounded me and put a gun to my chest and said, "Give me your money." And I said no. Because giving up my money would mean I couldn't get what I really wanted. And I realized at that point that I needed to get loaded more than I valued my life. And no wasn't the answer that these guys wanted. So I was pistol whipped and beaten, and they took all my valuables, and they left me in a tenement in a pool of my own blood, unconscious. And I came to after a while, and... I crawled out to the street and I flagged down a mailman who brought me to the ER, and they stitched up my head and let me go. And a couple days later, I was at somebody's apartment and I overdosed. And it happened to be that the woman I was with was an aerobics instructor. And she basically pumped my chest and brought me back to life. She found me on the bathroom floor. I hit the floor. And she pumped my chest, brought me back, and somehow I ended up on the bed. And as soon as my eyes opened, I wanted more. the booze was gone. Everything was gone. And I'm like, where is it? She's like, no, you're done. And, you know, she kicked me out. And about a week later, I was in the ER because I developed an infection. And to this day, I don't know what it was. They don't know what it was, but I was in the ER. And they admitted me to the hospital. I had like 105 fever, and I had this rash all over my body, and I was incoherent. And they had me in isolation, I remember. So anybody that came in my room had to have like full scrubs on and stuff. And it was like when AIDS was just, I guess they thought I had AIDS. I don't know what they thought, but I was in this room for a week, I learned. I don't remember much of it. But they called my family, and they said, we have your daughter, and we don't think she's going to live out the week. We don't think she's going to make it. And nobody came. And I know that's not because they don't love me. They were just done. You know, they tell me now that for years they were just waiting for the call to come get my body. So I had to write a lot of resentment inventory about that one. But I understand today. I really do. I get it. So I went through another detox in rehab, another detox in Chicago and whatever, and I went back to Minnesota. And and it was probably December. I don't know. But I did have friends there that managed to stay sober. And I was just so beaten down. I had nowhere else to go. And she said, if you want to get sober, you'll call this woman. And I called this woman. I ended up driving up to Ham Lake, Minnesota. Ham Lake, Minnesota. It just cracks me up. But I went up to Ham Lake, Minnesota. And this woman said, you know, Janice, I think you need to stay here for a little bit. And I didn't know this woman. She didn't know me. And she had three little kids with her, and she invited me to come live with her. You know, she had no idea who I was, and she had small children, and it's amazing that she invited me to stay in her home. And, you know, she saved my life. And I lived with her for about 3 months. And she introduced me to the big book, and I started saying the third step prayer on my knees. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. I just did it because I was told to do it, so I started doing it. And after about 3 months, I moved back to St. Paul, and I was going to meetings, and I was staying sober and going to a lot of meetings. And I started working at this place called the Day by Day Cafe, which was actually this fantastic cafe, and I was waiting tables, and I was really happy. It was an amazing time in my life. Just being sober was amazing because I had never experienced it. I was going to a lot of meetings and going to step meetings and never working a step. They just didn't. I was never told to work steps. We would read steps out of the book or read them out of the 12 and 12. I don't remember, but I never worked a step. I had a sponsor. We'd go out for coffee. And, you know, I was the meeting maker. And I was, you know, I was not drinking. And I was pretty okay with that. And I thought that's what it was about. I went to graduate school. I got married. I finished graduate school, and I got a great job in Minnesota, you know, and life got real busy. And after about 4 years, I kind of backed out of AA. You know, I didn't make a conscious decision not to go. I just, you know, I was sober. Thank you very much. And I moved on. And, excuse me, I lasted a couple years like that. And then I started playing ball again. I play sports, and softball is a big part of my life. And I started playing softball again out there, and, you know, a lot of drinking. And I thought, you know, alcohol wasn't really my problem. So, you know, the decision was made for me, and I started drinking socially. And then I suffered this back injury from playing ball, and I was introduced to the world of pain medication. And I was off. You know, I started a whole nother run. And it was just like I had lived before, except, you know, I didn't think it was so bad because, you know, and I was getting them from a doctor, and that lasted so long. And I started, you know, scamming doctors and doing what I had to do to get what I needed. And I ended up moving back to New Jersey. I was married, like I said, I got married, and I have a great husband. I am blessed. And we moved back to New Jersey because we wanted to start a family, and I didn't want to start a family in Minnesota because all my family was back here. And moved back to New Jersey using and drinking. And I entered, God willing, my last detox facility in January of 2003. And I was pretty sick. You know, I was pretty sick. I was in detox for about 4 days. And actually, let me back up. Before I moved back to New Jersey, we lived in Brooklyn for a year, and I got pregnant and I had a child, and it's only through the grace of God that I was able to stop while I was pregnant, because I had no program, I had no God in my life. But when I got pregnant, I spent a week on my couch and stopped, you know, and it's only through the grace of God, because that had nothing to do with me. And then my son was born, and I went back. I got out of detox in 2003, and my husband had actually relapsed as well. And he went to detox a week before I did. And so he was already out, and he was taking care of my son, our son. And he started going to meetings. I was living in Denville at the time. And he went to a meeting, and God put these people in his life. It's just this amazing set of circumstances. And a sponsor was put in his life that night, and I got out a few days later, and this woman was put in my life, and I started going to Serenity Porch in Rockaway. And I remember my husband's sponsor said to me, if you want to stay sober, you'll call this woman. And I was a mess. I was really, really horribly sick, physically sick. And I called her up shaking, and she's like, well, meet me tonight at this meeting. And I so didn't want to go, but I went to that meeting, and I sat there, and I was shaking, and I was crying, and I was probably puking and sweating and a mess. And I started hearing some of the people in that meeting talking about recovery and talking about steps and talking about God. And I had stuff that I had honestly never heard in the 8 years that I was abstinent before. I had never heard people talking like this. And I can't deny what I was hearing. I was hearing people that were free, not just abstinent, but were free. And I didn't get it, because I realized looking back that, I mean, I had relief for those years that I was abstinent. I had relief because I wasn't, you know, chasing down a bottle or a drug every day of my life. I had relief, and I thought that's all it was. But for an alcoholic like me, that's not enough. And I learned that the hard way. So I heard people talking about a solution which I never really understood and never heard before, and was generally excited and full of hope for the first time in my life. And then I was brought to this meeting. And like I said, this meeting changed my life. And some of the people that are here tonight, I'm sure they remember what I was like when I walked in these doors, because it wasn't pretty. And I remember, you know, Mary Beth was one of the first women that came up to me. And, you know, I was this timid little thing. I was afraid to talk. And we were sitting out on the stairs out there. And Christine was there. And this other girl that was just showing up for the first time. And we were sitting on those stairs. And they were all talking and reading out of the book. And I was afraid to say anything. I just wanted to sponsor. But I couldn't even bear the idea of, like, interrupting or asking. So I just sat there, because I was just so full of fear. And you know, I asked Mary Beth to sponsor me, and she was just so sweet and so loving. And I remember her saying to me, you know, Janice, we're going to love you until you learn to love yourself, because I didn't know how to do that. And I know to this day that God put the exact right person in my life at that time. So I would meet her downstairs, and we'd go through the work. And I remember the first time I met her downstairs, you know, I have this, you know, wonderful, loving sponsor. And then Chris walked by and looked at me, and he goes, you are so much sicker than you think you are. And that scared the hell out of me because I knew I was pretty sick. And for him to say that really scared me. And, I kept coming. And then I remember I took a commitment and I helped to set up. And I was given a key. And it shocked me. It shocked me that they were giving me a key to this place. Again, it's like, don't you know who I am? I'm this horrible, sick, you know. And they gave me a key to this place, and I was so humbled, and I felt such a sense of responsibility to show up and open the place, and I had a key, and oh my gosh. It sounds so trite, but it was so meaningful to me. And this meeting really changed my life. You know, I never, ever missed this home group. I never missed it. I mean, I'm sure that I did, but I felt like I was here every single week. And I went through the work, you know. I was taken through the work as outlined in the big book. You know, we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer and I did my four step. And I remember going to Mary Beth and Chris's house and I didn't even know where to sit and I was so scared. And you know, I did my fifth step out by, you know, the brook that runs by our house. And I remember leaving my fifth step experience and, you know, I had all these expectations when I went through the work. Expectations on God, expectations on the work. And I remember after my fifth step, I was incredibly relieved. And I went home and I took the hour. And then after that, looking back, I had this huge resentment because when I was in Minnesota and going to all these meetings, I remember they would always read the promises, you know, the promises. And, you know, after I left AA in Minnesota, you know, I quit AA, as Niffin reminds me all the time. I'd hear the promises. I'm like, well, you know, AA doesn't work because none of these promises came true in my life. So AA doesn't work. But I never heard that part, you know, when they say, you know, at this phase of our recovery, at this phase of our development, I never heard that. I never realized that you had to do step 9. No one ever told me that. And, you know, I now know that there are promises attached to every single step in the book. And after my fifth step, I expected all these promises to come true in my life, basically in the car on the way home. And they didn't. I copped a resentment. I thought my sponsor did it wrong and, you know, all this ridiculous stuff. And I kept going through with the work and I started making amends. And I was amazed before I was halfway through. You know, I was making amends and I felt great. And I was halfway through and I felt great. I was amazed and I, you know, basically quit making my amends. I completed steps 8.5. And I was sponsoring women. And then I moved. We moved down to Middletown, which is where I live now. And when I moved, you know, I had all my sponsees, you know, find other women and, you know, everything was fine, and I moved down to Middletown, and I started going to meetings down there, and, you know, I kind of say that Bernardsville spoiled me a little bit, because I would go to these meetings, and I wasn't hearing what I wanted to hear. I wasn't hearing the solution, and then I'd go, and I'd share, and nobody wanted to hear what I had to say, and, you know, a little spiritually arrogant I was. So, once again, I quit AA. I didn't make a decision not to go. I just kind of stopped going. And whereas, you know, when I was active here, I really was living in all three sides of the triangle. I really was. When I moved, you know, I stopped going to meetings and I wasn't being of service. I had no sponsees. I had absolutely no connection with any God, any kind of conscious contact with God. And I certainly wasn't working any steps. So, you know, one by one, every part of the triangle had fallen off, and I was just left with a big hole again. And as an alcoholic, what do I do when I have a big hole? You know, I was playing softball. And, you know, my parents, they always say that. They're like, you should quit playing softball because you know. Or they point at modeling. This is why you're like that. I'm like, no, it's got nothing to do with softball or modeling. I'm an alcoholic. That's why. So, one day I was playing ball and I got injured. You know, I think I like hurt my pinky or something. And driving home from the ball game, suddenly showed up in my life. And the thought crossed my mind that if I went to the ER, and I was loaded within a half hour. The decision was made for me. I had absolutely no mental defense against the first drink, and I know that today. Whereas when I was working a program of recovery, I went through two knee surgeries, safe and protected. You know, Mary Beth showed up at the hospital when I came out of surgery. And I was able to get through those, you know, and I took medication for 2 days as directed because I was in a position of neutrality. I was safe and protected. I wasn't in the obsession, you know. I had a contact with God at that point. And, you know, and once I lost all that, you know, and suddenly showed up, like I said, I went to the ER, I was loaded within a half hour, and stayed loaded for a good year. And tried really hard to stop on my own. Really hard. I would go to meetings, and I got a sponsor down there, a woman that I had known actually from meetings when I was in Rockaway, and she tried so hard to help me, and I was unable to get honest, and I'd tell her I had a few days sober, I had a couple weeks sober, and I was lying the whole time, and I couldn't do it, and I really did not want to ask God for help. I just didn't want to do it. Because I knew that if I got on my knees and asked for help, that I'd end up in another detox or another rehab or, you know, back in these rooms. When God knows that the happiest years of my life when I was sitting in these rooms and working a program of recovery. But then came the day where I really had nowhere else to go. I had no other choice, and I actually, you know, I got on my knees and I begged God for help. And got honest with my sponsor at the time that day, and she did not know what to do with me. God bless her. And she said, you know, I want you to call this person. I said, okay. And I had no idea why, but I just said, okay. And I called this person, and I asked for help. And my life has never been the same. And the first time, you know, a new teacher was put in my life the very next day. And the first time that I met with my new sponsor, you know, he asked me, well, how long, you know, the first time I asked him for help, and I had known him from the rooms for years, so he knew a little bit of my history, and I asked him for help, and he said, no, you know, I want you to go ask this woman, and this woman, and this woman, and I did, and they all said no. So I was brought back. And he said, yeah, I'll help you, but you got to wait a few weeks, and okay. And so the first time I met with him, he asked me how long you've been sober, and I lied. I said 3 weeks, and it was a lie. I think I'd been sober 3 days. And I sat in what's now my home group in Union, the whole meeting, just like, you know, I can't do this anymore. So at the end of the meeting, I ran up to him. I'm like, I lied. I don't have 3 weeks. I don't have 3 weeks. I have like 3 days. And he's like, okay, you know, we can work with this. Okay. So I started going through the work again. And like I said, he knew a little bit of my history. And what he said to me the first time that he met with me, he's like, Janice, knowledge you have, it's power that you lack. And that's very true. I mean, when I went through the work previously, I had an experience with God and I stopped. But I continued to have an experience with the work. You know, I would read the book, I'd go to step meetings, I'd go to big book meetings, I was taking women through the steps and I could quote you the big book and I could sound really good in meetings. And I was really a prey to knowledge. And I absolutely had no power in my life anymore. So that's what he said. You know, knowledge you have, it's power you lack. Let's get you some power. And he wanted me to have an experience with God and not an experience with the work. And he took me through the work in a way that I've never been taken through before, very, very quickly, very thoroughly. And he also said to me really early on is, I want to get you dependent on God and independent of me as soon as possible. Which turned out to be a lot quicker than I anticipated, because a lot of times, you know, I'd call him in desperation and panic and he was not available. So, and then I would call other people in desperation and panic and, you know, they would laugh and say, okay, you're expecting all this in your time again, and maybe, you know, there's a reason for this. And I would just go down the list. If my sponsor wasn't available, I'd call the next one and the next one and the next one. And, you know, there were a couple times where nobody was available, and it was me and God. I went through the work, like I said, I went through the work again, you know, did another third step on my knees with no expectations on the outcome. I had no expectations going through the work. I was just trusting it. And I wasn't expecting God to fix me the way I'd expected God to fix me my whole life. My whole life was about looking for my next fix. And that's how I always expected God to work in my life, as a result of my third step, my fifth step, all that stuff. And this time going through the work, I had absolutely no expectations. I got up off my knees in the third step. I didn't see the burning bush, and I didn't get pissed off about it. I did another fifth step. You know, I had relief, didn't see the burning bush, and I had no white light, and I didn't get pissed off. I just kept going. I didn't expect, you know, whatever I did or didn't feel, it was okay. I just kept going. Started out making my amends again, and, you know, it was just on fire. My amends were amazing, amazing. I have never had an amends go bad, and I've heard some really horrific stories from some people, but my amends process has always been really fantastic, and I couldn't wait to make the next one. There were some amends, you know, I was setting about making amends for some of my distant pasts, amends that I had never made before, you know, from 20, 30 years ago, that I was in full-on fear of making. You know, one of the biggest amends I was really scared of making was to my mother-in-law. For a whole host of reasons, there were a whole host of harms, I owed her amends for. And all of a sudden, you know, my husband tells me, you know, she's coming down, like that day. And I was instantly in panic. And, you know, I started the round of phone calls, called my sponsor, not available. And I kept going down the line, and nobody answered the phone. And it was just me and God. And I started praying, and she showed up, and I made the approach. And, you know, it was fantastic. And I brought fear, and, you know, God delivered love. And where that amends went was just beyond anything I could have even imagined. This woman that, you know, I made the amends, we went through that process, and then she just started asking me a whole bunch of questions. You know, what are you doing, and what's this about? And she knows that I'm in, you know, we're in AA, and she, you know, she's had two sons that have had this disease, and so she knows the deal. But I guess no one's ever made amends to her before. But she started asking me all these questions, and I never talked about God. You know, there's certain people that I just don't, you know, I don't bring God into it. And she started asking all this stuff. And, you know, what are you doing, and why do you do this? And this woman who hates God is very resentful at God for the horrific things that she believes that God has done to her. And she's had a very, very hard life. Hates God. And she started asking me all this stuff. And, you know, I talked freely about where I'm at and what I'm doing. And, you know, at 10 o'clock that night, we're sitting in my living room floor, and I'm teaching her how to meditate. And that's one of the most powerful experiences in my life. It was just unbelievable. This woman that I couldn't even talk to, all of a sudden, you know, we're talking about God and meditating in my living room. Just fantastic. And all my amends have, you know, been like that. Just, I couldn't wait to make the next one. It's just really, you know, propelled me forward. Prayer and meditation is a big part of my life today. I did not know how to meditate. My sponsor taught me how, the logistics of what to do, how to sit and, you know, different postures. And I was, 2 minutes on a timer, and 2 minutes seemed like 2 hours. But I kept doing it because I was told to keep doing it, and I just kept doing it. And then, 2 minutes grew to four, grew to five, grew to eight, and I started pursuing a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, outside of AA and other spiritual practices. And I've become really open to a lot of different things, you know, exploring spirituality and God in a whole bunch of other ways. Brought up Catholic and didn't really want to go back that way. And I had to do a lot of writing about old belief systems. But in recovery, you know, I've gone back to the Catholic Church just out of curiosity, you know, and I've gone to other churches as well. Just why not? You know, I'm looking, you know, to experience God in as many ways as I can. I go to a Zendo every weekend. I sit with a meditation group every Sunday. And meditation has really changed the way I live my life and the way I show up for my life today. And it's not just about, you know, the half hour I sit every day or the time I sit with my group, or it's changed the way that I show up for life, and it's changed my family. You know, I've been going through something the past couple of weeks, and I don't really get spun out that much about stuff. You know, I'm able to write inventory and get to the fourth column pretty quick and move on with my day, and I don't really get spun out about stuff much anymore. And I was going through something last week that I could not get out of. And, you know, I'd keep going into meditation. I'd keep getting present. And I could not stop the thoughts. So I was writing inventory. But what I was also noticing is that as I was, like, spinning out and losing my bearings, so was my family. You know, as I started getting well, my whole family got well. It was amazing. The power that I have just by living my life with more peace and more calm and being less selfish in my life, the profound effect that's had on my family, especially my son. My family has been able to heal. And that's only because of the grace of God and, you know, the work that I've done in this program. I've taught my son how to meditate, which is really interesting because he's only 8 years old. And sometimes he'll sit with me, he's like, Mom, this is just really boring. But every now and then, it's really funny. I walked by his room the other day, and he was actually in a timeout. And he was sitting on his bed, meditating, with his eyes closed. And I was just really moved by that. And I talked to my son about being present. You know, I believe that my God works through people, and my God works through my son a lot. My son is one of my greatest teachers. He really is. We were driving somewhere the other day, and I was just asking him, like, Jack, you know, what do you want me to make you for lunch? He's like, I don't know, Mommy. I'm living in the moment. God bless him. And every now and then when Mommy gets impatient, he's like, Mommy, I think you need to go have Zen time. I swear to God, my kid, like, as I, you know, send him to time out, he sends me to my cushion. He's like, Mommy, you need Zen time. So, but like I was saying, this past week, I was getting a little spun out about stuff, and I was getting a little self-reliant and self-involved and impatient and intolerant and, you know, and I could see it affecting my family. My husband was getting impatient. My son was acting out. And I could just see, you know, how the way I live my life just profoundly affects them, good and bad. And you know, I can't live so selfishly anymore, because no matter what I'm going through, I have to realize the profound effect that it has on everybody around me, especially, you know, those closest to me. But what meditation has given me is this sense of peace that I can return to any time, day or night, just by going back to breath. And I do it a lot. You know, I did it in the car on the way down here. I do it in the grocery line a lot. You know, the other day I was in the grocery line and there was a kid in front of me screaming and I was late and there's somebody waiting for me. And, you know, I just go back to breath and I just breathe. And I remember my sponsor saying to me, and I hear him say it all the time, you know, turn in to turn out. And I was always like, what the hell does that mean? I don't get it. And I understand that today, that if I can turn into God, which I believe was always within me, but was so blocked from it with all the crap that I've accumulated over my whole life, if I can turn into that peace and that stillness and that quiet that is my God, I can face life successfully. You know, not on life's terms, but on God's terms. So I try to do that a lot, because I need to do it a lot. So, you know, this thing I've been going through lately, like I said, I was writing a lot of inventory and it just wasn't feeling right. I couldn't get to it and I called my sponsor again, unavailable. And, you know, I started going through the list and got a hold of somebody else and started talking about this stuff and realized, you know, there's like such a deeper underlying fear attached to all of it. And that's the benefit that I have of being able to read inventory or talk about this stuff with another person on this path, because they can get me to see the truth where I'm unable to see it most of the time, even when I write inventory. And even when I can get to my fourth column pretty quickly, sometimes I still can't see the truth. So, you know, I learned a hard lesson this week, and that is, you know, even if I think that I've solved the problem by getting to the fourth column, I still need to share it with somebody. Because a lot of times that's still not getting to the truth. And, you know, somebody else helped me to see the underlying fear that I was actually really experiencing that I couldn't get to. You know, I'm very lucky that I get to, you know, it's amazing that I get asked to speak anywhere. It's just, it shocks me still. And that I get invited into people's lives and women ask me to help them. It does shock me. But I'm really grateful. You know, I have a good group of women that, you know, I'm working with and taking them through the work. And I've learned from experience that they help me so much more than I've ever helped them. And I learned that when I moved and I lost all of them, how empty I felt. So it is a gift, you know, that I can help other women in this program. It's just, you know, it's, I remember hearing early on that I'd hear people say that they were grateful to be an addict or grateful to be an alcoholic. And I just thought they were insane. Cause you know, this has been, I just always saw it as this big curse. And, today I see it differently. You know, it is a blessing. Some of the women I work with, they're like, I just want to go back to that person I was before I ever started drinking or using drugs. And I'm like, no, you don't. No, you don't. If you're anything like me, you'd just be selling yourself way short. You know, the person I was before I was drinking or using drugs needed to drink and use drugs to get through life. And as a result of this program and the tools that I've been giving, I can deal with life today. You know, pretty happily. It's amazing to me. I don't have relief anymore. I genuinely have freedom. It's a miracle. It really is. And I can actually say that I'm grateful to be an alcoholic today, which shocks me. Because when something comes up in my life, I have a whole host of people I can go to. I have a God I can go to, and I have tools that I can go to help me deal with life every day. And it's a gift, because there's a whole lot of people out there that don't have this disease, that don't have that kind of support and that kind of help to get through their life. So, you know, my biggest lesson was, you know, alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was my solution. and I needed to get a new solution, or I was, as experience shows, I was doomed to go back to my old solution over and over and over again, which I did. So, you know, I'm grateful that I have a new solution in my life. And, you know, a solution that I really do pursue every day. I don't look at steps 10 and 11 as maintenance steps, because I lived on maintenance for a lot of my life. Maintenance drugs, maintenance drinking, maintenance sobriety, maintenance spirituality, and maintenance doesn't work for me. I have to grow in understanding and effectiveness, and I have to improve my conscious contact with God. And like I said, I've pursued it. I've gone to Quaker meetings, which sound really funky, but they're really amazing. I don't know if anybody hears, you know, I pictured, like, you know, the pilgrim hats and the buckle shoes and... But there are these, like, silent meditations on God. It's really amazing. And, you know, I'm open to this stuff today. And, you know, a few years ago, I wouldn't have been. And my son's in CCD, and he comes home from CCD, you know. And it's this weird thing now, because he's, you know, in Catholic CCD, and he's talking about the Ten Commandments and mortal sin, and I'm like, oh, jeez. And I really don't know what to do with that, because that's not my God today. And, you know, I have no judgment against that. That's just not where I'm at today with my relationship with God. And I just, you know, I keep him open to everything. And I have a relationship with my God today that, for the most part, I don't understand. And I'm really, really good with that. Because early on in AA... You know, when I first got sober in 2003 and, you know, coming to these meetings, I would ask people, what is your God? And can you please describe your God to me? And I really needed to understand God. That's just where I was at. I needed to get it. And people would tell me certain things, and it didn't work for me. And I remember Barefoot Bill saying, it's like a wave. And I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And I don't need to figure it out anymore. And I'm really, really okay with that. I don't understand God, but the understanding I do have of God is working for me. And it's changing all the time, and it's evolving, and I seek it in different ways. And I'm always open to a new experience. And in fact, I was just asking my sponsor, who's got this, he always talks about this afternoon thing that he does, and I never really talks about it. And I asked him, like, what is it that you do? Because I'm just looking for, you know, whatever other experience I can have. You know, I'm just looking to, you know, it says somewhere in our book that something about relapse, you know, because we failed to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life. And that is my history. So I really don't want to go back out there again. So I seek to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life as much as possible. And, you know, seek God in a whole bunch of different ways. And whatever kind of experience I can have with God. I don't know. I'm just really grateful to be here. And it really means a lot to come home to this meeting. And it's very moving. And there's a lot of people out here that have really helped change my life and are at the other end of the phone when I'm calling in tears, you know. And I'm really grateful for that. So I want to thank you all.